Welcome, this is Mark Bauerlein here for another conversation. Today we have Father Peter Stravinskas, who is editor of the Catholic Response and executive director of Catholic Education Foundation. I'll mention an event that he's hosting this summer. It's a conference at Seton Hall University for bishops, priests, and seminarians entitled The Role of the Priest in Today's Catholic Schools. That will be July 17th to the 19th. I imagine people can type that title into Google and it will come up.
Or CatholicEducationFoundation.com.
There you go, CatholicEducationFoundation.com. We'll have all the information for that. Welcome, Father.
Good to be with you.
Now, the first issue that came up when I thought of asking you to come in was Ireland. What happened in Ireland this week? Would you like to just go?
Okay. Well, if anyone thinks that what happened in Ireland last week emerged full-blown from the brow of Zeus, he's very much mistaken. This has a long history, and it's more than 10 years ago. In my judgment, although the common judgment is that it's connected somehow to the clerical sex abuse thing, this goes back decades, and I would say even a century and a half. And it's this. The church in Ireland was a very, very strong church with a mentality of the role of the laity was to pay, pray, and obey.
Pay, pray, obey.
That's it. And so when Cardinal Newman was asked by Cardinal O'Connell to start the Catholic University of Dublin, you had two very, very good men who were at loggerheads from day one because Newman understood a university in his experience of it at Oxford. It was to be creating what he called an educated laity. Cardinal O'Connell, on the other hand's idea, was make them good practicing Catholics. Well, that would be no different from in the United States having a CCD program, a religious ed thing, and give people the basics of the catechism. And so the two of them did not see eye to eye. In very short order, Newman resigned as president, the college fell apart, and that was it. As time went on, you had the emergence of intelligent, well-educated Catholic Irishmen, but whose religious education very often was very little more than the basic catechism. And when questions started to be asked by them, they were perceived as troublesome. And so you had an individual with a doctorate in physics, but whose level of theological perspicacity would have been that of a seventh or an eighth grader. And so it wasn't that someone was challenging the teaching of the church, let's say on sexual relations, simply asking why it's that. And then often that was perceived as a threat. My experience of Irish clergy and religious goes back to my grammar school days. As I've mentioned to you, although my family is Eastern European background, we didn't belong to an Eastern European parish because they didn't have any schools.
Where did you grow up?
Newark, New Jersey. And so I went to the so-called Irish parish, which was the territorial parish, where we had 2,000 kids in the parish school, almost equally divided among three ethnic groups, Irish, Italian, Eastern European. We had 35 sisters, 33 Irish, one Italian, one Slovak. We had seven priests, all seven were Irish. And I had a wonderful, wonderful experience of Catholic education, kindergarten to 12th grade, except for one thing. We non-Irish were made to feel very often like strangers in our own house. The equation was, if you're Catholic, obviously you're Irish. And that played out in a lot of very, very subtle ways. It also played out in the way of not giving reasons for why things were requested or demanded. And that creates resentment. And I think that's what we find really blowing up in the face of Ireland right now. My first time in Ireland was 1983. I had a pilgrimage group of Catholic Europe. And one of our stops, obviously, was Ireland. And when we were in Dublin, I said to our group, rather than my celebrating a mass every day for the group privately, where our hotel is just down the street from the cathedral, let's go there. I'll come celebrate with whoever the priest is, and you can get a taste of Irish Catholic culture. And it was marvelous. It was the mass, 8 o'clock mass every morning at the cathedral was packed, standing room only. Two or three priests would assist with distributing Holy Communion. And in our, back in the States, it wasn't clear if we were going to be emerging from the mess of the post-Vatican II confusion. There were signs that we might be, but it wasn't too clear. But certainly, this was an intact church. Ireland still had no divorce, no abortion, and mass attendance was through the roof. 80-90% mass attendance.
In the early 80s.
1983.
While other countries
were already in massive decline. And at the end of the week, I said to the priest, who was the celebrant for that mass all week long, who was a young guy. I was young. I was 32. He was probably 28 or 29. And I said, Father, I've got to confess some degree of envy of what you have here. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, the devotion, the attendance, and I went down this whole laundry list. And he said, Father, don't be too impressed. He said, come back in 10 years' time and you won't find a stone upon a stone of the church in Ireland.
Hmm.
And I said, why is that? And he said, because the bishops will not understand that this cannot maintain itself in the way it's been maintained for 150 years. And he said, I raise these questions and I'm told I'm a troublesome character. And now he was off. He said 10 years, actually it took 20. But the bottom line is exactly the same. That priest saw something that none of the bishops at the time either saw or wanted to see. And so with the situation 2 years ago of gay marriage in Ireland, and now this. And in both instances, two fascinating facts to me. In both instances, these situations were voted on for the first time by a plebiscite.
Direct
by
voting.
The people. In all the other countries, whether it was gay marriage or abortion, it was either a legislature or a judiciary that did this. This was 66% of people in Ireland last week voted for abortion. And what I find also interesting is that's even 4% higher than voted for gay marriage. So 66% thought it was okay to kill a baby, while only 62% thought it was okay for a man to marry his friend.
How much of the what you've said is very informative. How much of the vote do you think was a vote on choice disconnected from issues of the church?
I think a lot of it, I think they've used the clerical problem as the excuse or the justification. Back to that episode in 1983 with the priest at the cathedral, when I said, you don't have abortion here. And he said, Father, every Saturday morning, 200 fine Catholic lasses from Ireland get on a flight to London. They tell their families they're going to shop at Harrods. He said, they do shop at Harrods after they've had their abortion in London. And so he said, you know, this has been in the pipeline for a long time. And now, of course, it's just going to be easier. That's the only difference. It's not that it hasn't existed. And so I think it's not so much a backlash against. And I think also there's been a dearth of leadership on the part of the Irish bishops. That vote never could have occurred in the United States, ever. And certainly not from practicing Catholics. And, you know, we have our problems here, but my friends in Ireland said to me, the bishops of the United States have been in the forefront of all of these issues, and whether or not they've been successful, they've been faithful.
Now, will the bishops continue this in Ireland as, will they take this as a challenge? Will they take it as a fight that they have to continue to fight? Or is it, okay, that issue settled. Let's just move on.
Well, I think there are two issues here. One, Archbishop Dermot Ryan of Dublin already has weighed in on this last week at deacon ordinations in at the seminary. He already said that the church needs to broaden its concept of pro-life, and that this would make it all much more appealing. And so it's sort of the Cardinal Bernardine seamless garment thing. We're going to bring everything into a big tent, and somehow or other these issues are co-equal. And perhaps if they're seen that way, that maybe there'll be some less resistance. This is absolutely absurd, right? And now one of the bishops of Ireland actually issued a pastoral letter last week, a response to this, saying anyone who voted for this needs to go to confession before receiving Holy Communion. That's leadership.
Interesting.
And but there's this been this blasé attitude toward confrontation. And I always say people who try to avoid confrontation or conflict end up in more conflict as a result of it. And
that's but, what we see here in the United States, it seems. If you the main forces, the progressivist forces, they continue. They are going to continue. They're going to push harder on ever more exotic and rare forms of, we'll say, transgression or freedom. And it won't stop because in this world, as one person put it to me a while ago, if you don't believe in transcendence, there is no curb on what you can do and want to do, feel the need to do.
Well, Dostoevsky says, if there is no God, everything's possible.
Yeah, and which means it's not just everything's possible, it's just we have to try to make everything that is possible, everything that is potential, actual. That's a progressivist urge, and if that isn't confronted, it just keeps going.
Now, let me just put a codicil on the whole Irish situation. I've been there several times in the past few years doing retreats and workshops and speaking at conferences. And while there's a certain bad drift that was clearly in evidence last week, there's also a resistance, and it's coming from young Catholics who are serious about their faith. So it's not the cultural Catholicism, all right? So it's not I was baptized or my grandmother went to Mass and so I do it a couple times a year.
It's real.
Yeah, it's real. And these young people are convinced and convicted of their Catholicism, and they're taking their signals from young Catholics in the United States.
Hmm.
And I mean,
Is the church going to be a place for them?
Well, it will be perforce and in a number of ways. Although the church in Ireland is, you know, terribly weakened with its native population, it also has a large number of immigrants who are Poles and Nigerians, who are devout Catholics, and who are insisting on proper pastoral care. And their young clergy, and I've given priest retreats in Ireland, the young clergy there are just like the young clergy here and all around the world. They are traditionally minded, and they know that what they've been fed is bad, and they don't intend on providing that same diet to people as priests. So there is reason to hope, and I'm very involved I've been involved over the years with Anthony Murphy, who is the editor of the Catholic Voice in Ireland. It's the real Catholic paper. There are others that are marginally so, but he runs workshops and seminars and conferences, and last time I was involved with one of those, probably 70% of the people were under the age of 40. And so there is reason to hope, but if you're looking for institutional benchmarks, you're going to have a problem still.
Well, look, we need the young ones who have that kind of youthful principle. They can be obstinate, they can be fired up, but we need that because I see too many people our age, middle age and older, who they've just been acclimated for too long. to being on the side of slow deterioration.
Well, this is the problem with cultural Catholicism, wherever it exists. Sometimes you'll hear, you know, so-called traditional Catholics say, well, before Vatican II, Catholics in America didn't practice birth control or abortion, they didn't get divorced, blah, blah. Nobody did, right? Catholics weren't unique in that regard.
Yeah.
They were simply a part of the overall American culture, which was, you know, sort of a pan-Protestantism. And so there was no merit attached to doing those things that everybody else did. As a matter of fact, I mean, as a kid, we knew people who had divorce in the family. It was a secret. You didn't talk about it.
No, there was a stain.
You know, all right? And that was the problem with American Catholicism. It was so tied to, and it was this Catholic, American Catholic inferiority complex. I always say it's like the little dog with the nose trying to get in the other side of the window, right? Always trying to be American, always trying to be accepted. And the result is, once the culture changed, our people changed with it, because they were never given the equipment to be countercultural. Catholicism, by its very nature, is countercultural. And when we get comfortable with a culture, we end up losing every time.
I think that holds, certainly. Let me shift to another issue that came up, not far from you, the Philadelphia situation with the foster care thing that happened last week. Do you want to fill our people in on that?
Well, it's bizarre beyond imagining, because Philadelphia, like New York, the largest provider of social services is the Catholic Church. And secondly, done with almost on a shoestring because of a lack of a lot of bureaucracy, and tremendously effective. And my intuition is that...
And then there were, well, just to fill people in, there were, among the many providers of foster care services,
right,
were two Catholic institutions who had been doing this for years with the city, but now they have been...
Banned
from providing those foster
care
services.
Because they refuse to engage in gay adoption.
Okay.
Which has been an issue in many other places. I'm pleased that the Archdiocese has not closed down its foster care from its own side, whereas other dioceses have simply said, oh, well, it's useless, let's just drop foster care. And my impression is that there is and there will be a groundswell of support for the church. There is a black woman, not Catholic, who has over the past 30 or 40 years said she's adopted over 130 children, all through Catholic charities. And she said, I wouldn't dream of taking an adoption from anyone except Catholic charities, because of the support system that's there and the lack of the bureaucracy, the one-on-one care and involvement.
These two Catholic organizations made up, I was reading a story on this, make up only maybe 1 or 2%.
Right.
So you have a massive set of alternatives to the Catholic option, but these guys have got to go.
Right.
That's the outlook. Now, what motivates this absolutist approach? I mean, if you can just go down the street to someone else and get the same thing, why the necessity of eliminating anything?
Our Lord talked about this 2,000 years ago. If the world has hated me, know it will hate you. This is hatred, pure and simple. It has nothing to do with isolated episodes or issues. It is, we have to eliminate the Catholic Church from the public forum. Now, if you want to have some kind of, you know, bizarre rituals in the four walls of your church and you want to believe weird things, that's okay. We won't stop you, at least not yet. But we're not going to tolerate that in the public forum. And it's also because we're the biggest, the most organized, the most visible of any religious institution in the country. And so it's not simply after us. It's after us because get the big boy down and everything else will fall like a house of cards after that. You know, you generally don't find, you know, great civic opposition to fundamentalists. I mean, they don't like them. They think they're hayseeds and they're, you know, stupid or backwards. But you don't find the same, because they can't deal with them in the same way. You know, the pastor of Shiloh Baptist Church is the pastor of Shiloh Baptist Church. There's nothing more than that. With us, there's an entire structure. And that's the problem. The structure is the problem. And the effectiveness, the social integration of the structure is the issue.
Do you sense that more Catholics in America are starting to recognize that the campaign of tolerance and inclusiveness, let's say, is really an aggressive campaign of removal and elimination?
Well, I think what you find is the Catholic community in the United States is about evenly divided. Years ago, I befriended George Gallup Sr., who was the pollster, and who was a staunch arch-conservative Episcopalian, and therefore already in the 80s was alienated from his own theological situation. But he and I would have lunch several times a year, and one time I said to him, you know, I think your polls are skewed because you simply say Catholics voted this way or said this or are committed to this particular point of view. And he said, well, Father, what else can I said, there are two different communities that are here, practicing Catholics and non-practicing Catholics, and they represent two different religions. And he said, well, I don't find that. And I said, no, you're not going to find that in Protestantism. Because if you self-identify as an Episcopalian, well, this is what you do. And also, it's a big, big tent, and anybody can believe anything or nothing. On one poll, he decided to separate out the two categories.
But by calling, practicing? I mean,
that's right.
How did he divide that up?
Have you been to Mass in the past month?
Okay. And then you can, yeah. Right.
And he called me up and he said, my gosh, you're absolutely correct. He said, there are two entirely different universes. And we saw that, for example, with when Obama was on his campaign against the church with the birth control mandate.
Uh-huh.
And Catholics who went to Mass on Sunday were 70% against Obama. Catholics that did not go to Mass regularly were 70% in favor of him.
Hmm.
And so it's...
You have to divide them then.
That's right.
If you're doing population surveys,
and it would be
you
no
must
different
divide as, that category.
And it would be no different from, in Judaism, saying, are you a Reformed Jew or an Orthodox Jew? Those are two different religions entirely. And their positions are entirely different in terms of socio-political realities.
Hmm. Okay, so the practicing, the Catholics who go to Mass... realize what is going on.
And particularly when they're well catechized, when the homilies are focused, when the priest is giving them some real direction, spiritual direction, about how to live the Catholic faith in the contemporary world. If it's pablum, well, it's not going to be any different because they're being fed that by the general culture. As priests, we have to give them the tools to, you know, have the proper lens to interpret.
When was the last time you saw a priest in a popular movie or TV show who really was a priest?
That's right.
We're treated as opposed to being
a buffoon.
Well, kind of a buffoon or sort of a friendly spiritual advisor of some kind, someone who cares about people, but a real priest.
But of course, this also has a long pedigree. Go back to all of the very positive films about the church from the 40s and 50s.
Bells of St. Mary's.
But it was also...
pretty soft.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's never,
right.
Never dealing That's with right. any serious issues. And in fact, you know, the priest there is pilloried rather than nun, who has standards for what it means to graduate from eighth grade. And he comes on the side of saying, well, just let her go. Huh. So already you could see this was in the water.
Yes.
And I always used to say, when I worked for the Catholic League, according to the New York Times, the only good Catholic is a bad Catholic. and so it's the same thing about priests. You're a nice guy. If you're a nice guy, you're a good priest. Yes. If you represent the truth of the gospel, you're hateful, or you're an agent of hate, or whatever else.
Right, right, right. You know, in my world of teaching, you know, the best teachers are the number one trait of a good teacher is he really cares about the kids.
That's right. That's right.
No,
and cares, and well, but shows it by having standards.
Well, that's genuine, but that's not what they mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
When they say cares about the kids, so all right, with the Philadelphia situation, with the you know, in Massachusetts, how many years ago that they actually closed the orphanage?
Almost 10 years ago, I think.
Did that change anything among Catholics in Massachusetts? I mean, I'm wondering about the impact that these actions against church institutions, which nobody claims are anything but positive institutions.
That's right.
I mean, no, there are no complaints filed against
That's
these
right.
foster care That's right. organizations. There were no complaints against the Massachusetts orphanages. There were no complaints against the Little Sisters of the Poor for doing right. bad things when they were hauled before the Supreme Court. I look at these things and I see there's some bad people out there who want to take down these good institutions. And what are we going to do about it?
Well, and see, of course, there's a unique problem also in Massachusetts with Catholicism. And it's largely Kennedy Catholicism. I remember joking in Obama campaign one, I said to Cardinal O'Malley, I was up there to do some things with him, and I said, I find it strange. I see no Obama bumper stickers, no Obama signs on lawns. And he said, oh, they don't need them.
it's done.
Yeah, it's a done deal.
It's already there.
And and that goes back to the Kennedy Catholicism. And I remember as a boy, I was in fifth grade when Kennedy was running for president. And his famous talk to the Protestant ministers in Houston. Now, I was, 11 years old. I watched the talk that night, and I thought there was something wrong with what he said. And the next day in school, I said to the pastor, Monsignor, what Senator Kennedy said last night, that wasn't right, was it? And he said to me, oh, don't worry, Peter. He said, he's just saying that to get elected. He'll be okay once he's elected. But a fifth grader understood there was something wrong, and the pastor was willing to give him a pass. And now Cardinal Spellman, on the other hand, you know, people always think of him as, you know, a New Yorker, which he really wasn't. He was a Bostonian. He was a priest and auxiliary bishop of Boston. And he knew the Kennedys upside down and backwards and was not impressed. And when he was asked during the campaign, what do you think of having a Catholic candidate for president? He said, it's something we should devoutly hope for someday.
Got it. Got it.
So, yeah, again, sometimes people have a very myopic view of, you know, how problems emerge, and they want to immediately pin it on something at the moment.
Right.
But most of these things have a long history.
Are these attacks, closures, bans going to continue?
Well, if we keep fighting them, they won't. I mean, I think they're going to keep trying. And to the degree that they have success, that will, you know, embolden them to move farther along the line. But, you know, the defeat of the HHS mandate was a major, major issue, all right? And no one's talking about that now.
I don't hear anything. No? You mentioned something to me earlier, and we'll conclude with that point. You don't hear anything about the International Planned Parenthood?
No.
Action that Trump took last week.
Right. Yeah,
what was that?
Well, you know, he returned. It's not, and some people are trying to say that this is a novelty of his. It's actually a return to the Reagan policies of defunding any organization that participated in any way in abortion, because the theory being, all right, they'll say, fine, this money is not going for abortion, it's going for, you know, women's
they
pap
just tests.
The
money
or, you know, that's, but that's fungible.
Yes.
And so, Trump has said, no, we're going back to the Reagan criteria. And it was $8.2 billion that was going to an international Planned Parenthood that's now out. To $8.2 billion.
They pulled out $8.2 billion.
Yeah. And I just read yesterday or the day before that as a result already, Planned Parenthood has closed down 22 clinics in Africa. If the, you know, the cow's not giving the milk anymore, they can't do their damage. And the local populations have been threatened by Planned Parenthood. I mean, and, you know, conditions put on various forms of aid and so forth in order to allow them to do their nasty work in Africa, which, of course, is completely consonant with their origins. I mean, Margaret Sanger was a racist eugenicist, and now they go there and do the same thing all over again.
And the African religious leaders are?
Adamantly opposed to their behavior.
And so they're overjoyed.
Absolutely.
Today.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. We need some of that joy here.
Yeah.
We need some of that. So, Father Stravinskas, thank you.
Pleasure to be with you, Mark.
We'll have you back.
Okay.
Thank you.